Our next speaker, his name requires 100 characters. 100 characters in his name. Let me tell you what his name is. I know it says Matthew Dentith, but his actual name is Matthew Richard Xavier Zander Xanthius Xerxes Xanatos X Dracos Hieronymus Oliphant Ransom Dentith. That's pretty much all he's got time for today. Who did this to him? Was there some conspiracy? That's what he's about to talk about. Please welcome, we'll call him Matthew.
Yes, and going through customs with that name can be a bit of a chore, because not only do you have to write out the full name on going through forms in, say, LAX, they go to your passport, that full name's not on the front page, so it can't fit onto the front laminated page. There's a go to page 3 marker in my passport, which has the full name written out. And I did it to myself, so I had no one to blame other than youthful exuberance when I got my MA. My name is Matthew Dentith. This is a short form of my name. This is a short form of essentially what my thesis topic in philosophy is. I'm writing a PhD in the epistemology of conspiracy theories, so I'm engaging in a philosophical discussion as to what conspiracy theories are and what kind of justification mechanisms we may or may not have to show whether conspiracy theories are warranted or not. My thesis currently is 81,000 words, 81,565 words in length. So don't expect a 30-minute presentation to give you all of the details that I'm going into. This will be rather slight. You'll have a chance to ask me questions at the end, and you can bundle me up in a corner throughout the conference, ask me even further questions. I have an awful lot to say about conspiracy theories. Half an hour really isn't going to cut the mustard. Let me talk to you about what I'm doing. I'm dealing with this thing called conspiracy theories, and these are things that lots of us have. And some of us actually will admit to, but most of us will actually shy away from admitting that we engage in conspiracy theorizing. We put out conspiracy theories about the world. Now, I define a conspiracy theory as simply being any explanation of an event that cites a conspiracy as its salient cause. This is a very low-level, quite simple definition, but allows us to do the following things. It allows us to say that any account of 9/11 is going to be a conspiracy theory. Whether you believe that the Twin Towers are brought down by hijackers led by Al-Qaeda, or you believe that the Twin Towers are part of controlled demolition by the executive branch of the government of the United States of America, they are conspiracy theories. They are explanations that cite conspiracies as the salient cause of the event. And I want to do this because I don't think we should be using the term conspiracy theory as a pejorative. One of the big issues we have in the field of studying conspiracy theories is that every single person who's writing on conspiracy theories feels a need to go, oh, well, this thing over here which I believe in is not a conspiracy theory. All these things over here which I don't believe in, they are conspiracy theories. So people use a pejorative term for no particularly good reason other than they favour one theory and they don't favour another. And I think we can actually propose a mechanism for explaining where conspiracy theories go wrong and why sometimes conspiracy theories can go right. Because there are examples of historically verified conspiracy theories in the world, as I'll talk about shortly. And this means, if we're not using it as a pejorative and we're accepting that any conspiratorial account is an explanation, then we can say that conspiracy theories range in their plausibility. And this is something that we should accept naturally from our understanding of explanations in the world. There are lots of explanations for phenomena. Some are plausible explanations, some are implausible explanations. By and large, as skeptics, what you go through and do is locate the plausible explanations and sort them out from the implausible ones. We should be doing the same thing to conspiracy theories and not just relegating them to a pejorative term we use to label people as holders of bad beliefs about the world. Now, to go through this, let me say a little bit about conspiracies. So a conspiracy is simply a plot hatched in secret or enacted in secret by a group of conspirators who want to desire some end. So a conspiracy, which comes from the verb conspire, to breathe together, is to plot in secret. That's really all a conspiracy requires. Some people want to put into the notion of a conspiracy a malevolent notion to it, so when people conspire, they are out to do bad things. This isn't necessarily going to be the case in all situations. There are going to be lots of historical examples of where people did conspire, but they believed they were doing the best thing. The best example of this, I think, is the assassination of Julius Caesar by a cabal of conspirators who were senators in the Roman Senate. There is certainly good evidence to indicate that they weren't killing Caesar because they thought killing someone was fun. They set out to kill Caesar because they wanted to re-establish proper pseudo-democratic control of the Republic back to the patricians who normally ran it and take power away from a tyrant. That doesn't seem to be a malevolent end. That seems to be something that people were doing for the good. Although there's going to be a certain amount of interpretation as to whether one person's conspiracy is good or bad, depending on how it affects you. So I don't think we need to put in the malevolent aspect here. We can deal with that with the context under which conspiracy theories operate. So conspiracy theories posit these conspiracies as the alleged cause of an event. Now, see, I've put alleged cause here. This is where we start getting into what I take to be the problems with conspiracy theories and why it's so hard to show that any individual conspiracy theory is in fact warranted. So why am I saying alleged cause? Well, one of the problems we have here is inferring why people do the things or did the things that they did. So conspiracy theories allege that conspirators desired to achieve some particular endpoint. And we have a problem here because we can only infer desires from behaviours or from reports. So for example, I could poll the, let's say class, this is my teacher mode on here, I could poll the audience and say, are you enjoying this particular presentation? Hands up if you are. I'm not going to actually do this because I don't want to be distressed. But some of you may raise your hands, and I could infer from that that yes, I have evidence of enjoyment of my presentation within the room. But of course, you actually may not be enjoying it. You may be doing it because, well, you know, he looks young, he needs some kind of encouragement, we need young people, I'll put my hand up and pretend I'm enjoying it. Or maybe you had an involuntary spasm and your hand rose automatically at the time. Or maybe you think you're enjoying it, but there's a sort of pressure to express that enjoyment, and actually a subconscious reason, if you were to spend time about it, would go, yeah, it's a bit rubbish. I mean, it's not saying anything particularly interesting or, in fact, novel. So, I raised my hand, but when I think about it, maybe I didn't. And in philosophy, there's a whole domain of study in regard to the inference to intentionality. And we don't necessarily have good grounds to accept such inferences due to the issues of trying to infer the mental states of people other than ourselves. We can try to infer them from their behaviour, we can try to infer them from reports of their behaviour, but none of that actually tells us what the mental state or desire state the person had at the particular time. And so we should be suspicious of any kind of explanation that attributes intentionality to an agent unless we've got really, really solid grounds for being able to say the inference is good in this particular case. And this is compounded in respect to conspiracy theories because we're not dealing with individuals. We're dealing with a group of mysterious conspirators. So we're not dealing with individuals, we're dealing with a complex of individuals acting in group behaviour. And this is problematic for a variety of reasons. One, often most conspiracy theories posit a few leading central conspirators whose names are known and whose desires are claimed to be reported, but often they're supported by a background of mysterious, shadowy figures operating in the background. So we need to deal with the fact that we're talking about group behaviour for a largely unknown set of people. And I think this should be a problem for any belief in conspiracy theories. This notion of trying to infer the intentionality of a conspiratorial group is a really, really hard ask. It's very hard to discharge the burden of proof here to say that your inference is in fact particularly good. So this is one problem I think we have for conspiracy theories as a species of belief about the world. Another problem It is actually the frustratingly vague endpoint that such conspiracy theories often have. Because conspiracy theories allege particular ends, things that people are conspiring towards, but there are questions of what counts as satisfying that particular end. Here are some fairly common end goals for conspiracy theories around the world. They desired to create a new world order. They wanted to start a war on terror. They felt the need to dumb down the population. These are end goals, but it's actually really easy to satisfy these end goals. If you decide to put in a brand new global taxation system, well, that's part of your wanting to start a new world order. If you decide to abolish tariffs on your borders, that can be taken as evidence towards a new world order. The war on terror one, you invade a country for its oil reserves, well, that's part of producing a war on terror. You introduce a Patriot Act to cause fear in your population, well, that's part of your desire to create the notion of a war on terror. It turns out that no matter what you do, it can be interpreted as supporting the end goal, because the end goal is not specific, it is general. It looks specific, but actually it's not at all. My favourite one here is dumbing down the population part, being involved in education. There's a certain thing that goes on that whenever the government or the university or the school system proposes any change to the curriculum at all, some say, oh, you're just trying to Mickey Mouse-ify our education system. You go from exams to skill-based learning, that's dumbing down the population. You talk about reintroducing exams, well, that's part of dumbing down the population at all. Introducing achievement standards, that's part of dumbing down the population. No matter what you do in the education system, you are completely and utterly damned. Because people have really, really, really hardline and strict notions as to how they think education should work, which often don't actually map to how people actually who study education think it does work, and any changes you propose, it's part of dumbing down the population. Holding conferences like this with simplistic half-hour presentations is part of dumbing down the population. Funny, because it's true, and some people might want to claim that they were conspiracy theorists. So I think there are these two chief problems for conspiracy theories. There are other problems, but the two chief problems are this inference to intentionality and what satisfies the end goal. There's another particular problem, which I won't go into in any particular depth, but I will mention it here. It's a variation of what's called the historian's fallacy, which is the other problem you get with conspiracy theories, is that how did the conspirators know that A, their plan was going to be successful, and B, all of the other vagrant things going on in the world around it weren't actually going to counteract against the plot. So there's also a large degree of post-facto reasoning that goes on with conspiracy theories and conspiracy theorizing. Now, all of this, I think, points to what I think is the chief problem for conspiracy theories, and is the focus of my particular PhD thesis, which is this thing called the inference to conspiracy. Now, the inference to conspiracy merely is the inference that some event came about due to a conspiracy. So it's simply saying when we infer the event coming about, we can infer that a conspiracy caused the event. But we've got to ask, how does the inference to conspiracy compare to our best practice as skeptics of the inference to the best explanation? So presumably, as skeptics, what you do is you take your particular facts about the world, the best sciences of your day, you take the context under which you're making your decision, and you go, given all of these considerations, I infer the best possible explanation in a particular case. Surely we're all going to agree that that's what we should be doing on a moment-by-moment, day-by-day, year-by-year, decade-by-decade, just actually all the time basis. So how does the inference to conspiracy compare, given that we have the problem of inferring intentionality, and given that we have the problem of trying to work out what the desired end goal is going to be, and what counts as satisfying that end goal? How does the inference to conspiracy compare? I think the inference to conspiracy resembles very closely the fallacious inference to any old explanation, or the so-called just-so fallacy. That often when people infer that a conspiracy brought about an event, they're going for a convenient explanation that is not the best possible explanation they could put forward at a particular time. Now, the inference to conspiracy in theory should be something that, given the right kind of information and the right kind of argumentation, you should be able to show that a conspiracy did actually occur. But in many cases, people who use the inference to conspiracy do not discharge the burden of proof to show that the inference to conspiracy resembles the inference to best explanation in this case. In many situations, when people infer to a conspiracy as being the cause of an event, they are committing the just-so fallacy. They're appealing to any old explanation rather than inferring to the best possible one. Now, one way to illustrate this, and this is one way to illustrate it, one avenue I take in the PhD thesis, is to talk about our sources of beliefs and how we use those to manipulate or justify the beliefs we have in the world. So I want to here talk about authority. So an authority is merely a source of beliefs about the world. And authorities can be people like your elders, your parents, your bosses, and so forth. If your boss says, "I'm thinking about giving you a raise," then that's a source of your belief that maybe you might be getting a raise. If your parent tells you that the sky is blue because God designed it to be painted that way by the angelic hosts, then that's a source for your belief that the sky is blue because God desired it to be painted in that particular way. But authorities are merely sources of beliefs. They're not sources of justified beliefs in many situations. What we should be concerned with when we're appealing to such sources of beliefs is whether they are epistemic authorities, sources of justified beliefs. And presumably, we should think that an exemplar of an epistemic authority are going to be people like scientists, people who have the right kind of accreditation, have gone through the right kind of training, and importantly, exist within communities which allow for a cut and thrust, a winnowing out of ideas, and a dialectic that allows their beliefs to be justified not just on their own personal genius, but on being on the shoulders of giants, having all sorts of people working with them, working through their beliefs and so forth. So epistemic authorities, sources of justified beliefs, are people who exist in communities of like-minded peers, and when they make utterances, they give us good grounds to believe those utterances because of the work they're doing as a community as part of transferring their justified beliefs to us as receptive and critical thinkers. And when we base our beliefs on authorities, we need to be aware what kind of authority we're dealing with. Whether we're dealing with a mere authority, say, like your unqualified father, or an epistemic authority, like your very well-qualified mother. So you need to be able to make sure. I was brought up in a matriarchy, so what the notion of a well-qualified mother really something ingrained into my thinking networks. You need to make sure that you're actually appealing to the right kind of authority, because otherwise you might be committing the fallacy of the appeal to any authority. So we need to make sure that we're dealing with the right kind of authorities in every situation. And in many cases, conspiracy theories are based upon the proclamations of mere authorities, people who do not have the right kind of accreditation or do not exist in the right kind of stabilized intelligence network. Well, that actually sounds really quite conspiratorial. Sometimes I pick entirely the wrong word. The right kind of networks to actually allow their views to be credited or justified in the right way. And here's actually a brief example. This goes into our climate change discussions previously. There are these people called UNIPCC expert reviewers. So these are the intergovernmental panel on climate change, as opposed to interplanetary climate change people, which is, when I was practicing the speech, I would keep on saying interplanetary, because it's very confusing. So what does it take to be a UNIPCC expert reviewer? The term here actually seems to indicate that the person who is the reviewer probably is going to be an epistemic authority. They're being put forward as an expert reviewer. But actually, it turns out the term is ambiguous. It suggests but does not entail the reviewer is an epistemic authority, because you can become an IPCC expert reviewer if you ask to review the first draft of the IPCC reports. So you can become an expert reviewer merely by application. any one of us here could be an IPCC expert reviewer if we really wanted to. So it suggests, but doesn't entail, the person is an epistemic authority. And this is part of a general problem people have, which is the notion that if, say, you are a scientist, then people think you must be an epistemic authority in a field relevant to the topic, without actually checking that you are a qualified scientist in the area being discussed. This is why there are lots of physicists who are intelligent design advocates, because they're Nobel Prize-winning physicists, but they're not particularly good biologists. So we need to make sure, our moral here, that epistemic authorities, when we appeal to authorities, we appeal to the right kind of epistemic authority. Short point here, because otherwise I'll run out of time. Of course, there are lots of mere authorities who think they are epistemic authorities. David Ray Griffin, in regard to the 9/11 truth movement, he has his PhD in religious studies, but he's now apparently a forensics expert, because you can do that once you know a lot about the New Testament. You're able to do a lot of forensic work in regard to ballistics. David Irving, in regard to German history, specifically the Holocaust denial. And one of my favourite here, Viscount Christopher Monckton, in regard to climate change skepticism, he has the mark of authority where it comes to an aristocratic peer, and he does seem to think that that gives him epistemic authority in regard to proclamations on climate change. It's really quite bizarre, mistaking of authority for epistemic authority.